Her body crashed through onto a large mattress she set on a rolling platform. Tsubaki grunted in pain when she hit the mattress, which rushed to the far wall where she had other padding placed. She could feel that her shoulder had been dislocated from the impact and grit her teeth as she pushed it back into place. More importantly, though, the rifle that she had been wearing snapped in half as soon as she hit the mattress. However, Tsubaki herself had survived, though she would need some time to recover. "Did I kill it?" she asked, her message being transmitted to Cece. "I can confirm. The monster was stunned by the explosive blasts, but ultimately died under the weight of the rubble falling on its body." Tsubaki let out a long sigh of relief, nodding her head. That was one of her trial targets down, and there were only two more to go, before she considered this a success. My brow twitched as I watched Tsubaki pulling off a stunt that would be hard to come by even in an action movie. "Really, she always pushes herself too hard," I said with a shake of my head, before becoming curious. "By the way, what is the void monster that she has to identify?" Cece cleared her throat, showing Tsubaki's face. The tinted glasses suddenly became transparent, revealing her bright red eyes. "Every day, the eye colors of every creature are randomized." That would explain why Tsubaki hadn't been able to identify it, given how simple it was. It wasn't likely that she paid attention to herself in a reflection that much. "I see. I was expecting something a bit more... well, more." "Due to the perils already present in the simulation, it was determined appropriate to use the least dangerous void beast options. Realistically speaking, Tsubaki should have died 18 times already, including this most recent hunt. Any further difficulty would have made success impossible." "Something that I've learned over the years," I said, while shaking my head. "Never try to tell Tsubaki what is or is not possible." Chapter 55. Once Tsubaki was able to move, she rolled herself off of the now ruined mattress that she had landed in, and worked on disentangling herself from the net. Although she had been confident in her escape plan, this was still her first time properly executing it. Once she had untangled the net and freed herself, she held her bad arm steady and turned to look at the broken remains of her gun. "If I had a good forge, I might be able to fix that. But..." She let her words trail off, seeing the shattered barrel and smashed scope. When she had landed on the mattress, the strap had been what pulled her shoulder out of its socket. Otherwise, she may have just been able to get away with a few bruises and some discombobulation. However, while there was certainly a mechanic shop in the city and even a blacksmith that she found, both of those were taken over by people. Given the settings that Tsubaki asked for in the beginning, there was no way of knowing who among the other residents of the city could be trusted. As time went on, it was actually more likely that anyone she found was possessed by a monster. Tsubaki let out a small sigh, kneeling down and resting her bad arm on her knee, as she used her free hand to retrieve the remaining ammunition from the rifle. Although she wouldn't be able to reuse the gun itself, there was no reason for her not to use the bullets. As she was doing this, she was planning out her escape path in the back of her mind. Now that the centipede was dead, it would be attracting some of the other giant monsters to its corpse for a free meal. While Tsubaki was highly uncertain about whether or not its meat was safe for regular consumption, that was naturally not a problem for these monsters. The sewers were not an option. Tsubaki had tried to navigate her way through them on her first day in the simulation, thinking it might make for a good network of passages throughout the city. However, something about seeing corpses strung up on a series of webs and spiders more than 6 feet long traveling in swarms of dozens convinced her quite swiftly that it was best for her to stay above ground. This was also the reason that she made sure to block every manhole cover that she found. Without magic or any form of special powers, even the weakest of these creatures took careful planning to defeat. Once she had acquired all of the resources that she could carry, Tsubaki grabbed the silenced pistol she stashed in the building ahead of time and made her way down to the street level. Her safe house was on the other side of the city, and she had to move fast if she wanted to get there before the sun went down. Along the way, as she ducked between alleys and behind cars, Tsubaki caught sight of a group of 6 residents, 3 men and 3 women. The women were armed with shotguns, while each of the men held a large machete. Judging from the states of the blades, they had seen recent action, blood and hair sticking to the blade. Tsubaki briefly froze up when she saw the group, doing her best to remain as still and quiet as possible. In order to complete her trial, she had researched each of the different types of monsters that had attacked the city. In total, there were 3 unique giant monsters, 6 large beast herds, and what she called the Stalker. The Stalker was the monster that would either possess or disguise itself as a normal person. For the most part, it appeared entirely normal. However, it had heightened strength, durability, reflexes, and senses. Judging by the gore on the machete, either this group was composed of stalkers, they had just killed one, or they were simply murderers. With 2 of the 3 options ones she would rather avoid, she had to do her best to avoid detection. This led to her hiding at the entrance of an alley for nearly 5 minutes until the group had fully left the area. Only then did she continue along her way. Her safe house was at the heart of the southern suburbs, as far from the identified danger zones as she could manage. As for its identity, really it was just an old family home that she reinforced with a bit of easy craftsmanship, such as barring the windows and trapping the doors. Thankfully, she managed to avoid detection along her route, temporarily disabling her own traps to allow herself inside. When she saw that none of them had been sprung, she was confident that her home was still secure. The first thing that she did was check the time, and then turned on an old radio that she had put together. Every now and then Tsubaki had heard broadcasts for help from other survivors, though she firmly ignored them. The reason that she kept listening to the radio wasn't because she was looking for other survivors, but because she wanted to monitor the government's response. On the 3rd day after the attack, she received a broadcast stating that there was a government bunker set up to the west of the city. Out of curiosity, she found a concealed spot more than a kilometer away to overlook the facility and hid within some deep foliage, watching the scope that had formerly been attached to a rifle. Through the scope, she saw survivors being escorted by those in military suits into what looked like a large barracks. She watched the scene for more than 3 hours until she had to hurry back to her safe house before it got dark. In that entire time, she didn't see any of the residents emerge from the barracks after entering it. Every now and then, one of the men in military uniforms would walk in and emerge carrying large trash bags. For a survivor camp, this was sending off red flags left and right, to the point where Tsubaki was certain that the base had been overrun by stalkers. Given how intelligent they were, it was even likely that they had inserted themselves into the highest ranks of the government. Thus, Tsubaki used the radio to listen for any offers of incoming aid. Because if she heard that, she had to immediately vacate the area, even if it meant leaving the area surrounding the city. Hearing nothing but static on her radio, Tsubaki nodded her head, shutting it off again. She wrapped her arm in a simple splint to let it recover and made her way to the bedroom. Along one wall, she had all of the information that she had gathered about the 10 different types of monsters that had attacked the city. Next to the wall of information, she picked up a dagger and thrust it into the picture of a giant centipede. For this simulation, Tsubaki had set herself a simple goal. Of the 10 types of monsters, it was too much even for her to kill off an entire species that had invaded. Thus, her targets were only the 3 giant monsters, each of which were larger than most buildings in the city. The first of these targets was the human-faced centipede, which she had previously killed. The next was a serpent. This one was tricky for Tsubaki to get information on, due to its ability to hide itself. The only picture she had of it was when she had lured it to stick its head out of a hole in a building that it had been hiding in. This serpent used its thin, flexible body to coil up inside of large buildings. If positioned properly, it could occupy multiple floors of an office building at once. At the same time, it was able to change the pigmentation of its skin, letting it be unseen at a distance. It was almost impossible to tell what building it was hiding in before entering, at which point it may be too late to leave. It was for this reason that Tsubaki avoided using large structures whenever she could. Her previous sniping post having been scouted for more than a day before determining that it was safe. "The serpent is cold-blooded, too, so I can't rely on any type of thermal imaging," she muttered to herself, before her eyes turned to the third picture. The third monster was undoubtedly the one that she would have the most trouble killing, as it was by far the most mystical. This monster was a giant crow, its wingspan more than 500 meters. It only ever appeared as the sun was setting, and was the reason why Tsubaki refused to remain outside after dark. She wasn't sure how the ability worked, but simply being gazed at by the crow was enough to cause someone to die. This ability was not limited to the survivors, as even other beasts would be struck dead the moment its eyes focused on them. A massive rhino had fallen dead one night outside of Tsubaki's safe house, the tremor from its fall waking her up. By the time she made it to peer through the curtains, she saw giant claws swooping down and carrying its lifeless body away. "Before I go after that one, I'll need to find where it roosts during the day." She nodded her head, though she wasn't even entirely sure that it slept in the city. It was possible it flew from a distant mountain. As she said that, Tsubaki heard a distant call, and her blood ran cold. Twilight was approaching, so the crow was out. She hastily turned off all of her lights, moving to an inner room without windows. These were lessons that she had picked up during the week that she had survived in this ruined city. If you want to survive at night, stay quiet, stay in the dark, in an enclosed space, and away from windows. None of the monsters in the city had a special ability to pass through walls, so the only thing she had to worry about were the spiders in the sewers. Thankfully, she had barricaded every manhole within a mile of her safe house, so that wasn't as much of a concern. She simply sat in the dark, closing her eyes to prepare to rest. However, before she could drift off, Cece's voice spoke up. "Tsubaki, you previously asked for me to alert you to log out at 5, according to local Olympus time." Tsubaki's brow twitched, but she nodded her head. "Thank you, Cece. Please log me out then." There was a rush of light in her surroundings that made Tsubaki's body tense up before she felt herself returning to her normal body. The flowing energy coursing through her bolstered her confidence, and she put a smile on her face as she sat up from her bed. She even flexed her shoulder, relieved that it wasn't hurting anymore. With her routine recalibration out of the way, Tsubaki made her way towards the communal kitchen, a bright smile on her face. Along the way, she saw the keeper standing in the hallway and blinked, before nodding towards him and offering a small bow. "My keeper, I was just on my way to prepare dinner. Is there anything that you would like to request for today?" "Whatever you want to make is fine," he assured her, looking like he had something on his mind. "Is anything the matter, my keeper?" she asked curiously. "Cece showed me the simulation you were in," he answered, and Tsubaki's ears stood straight up, as if she had been caught red-handed. "It's fine. I knew you were going to be doing a trial. Still, this one seems intense, even for you." Tsubaki gave a small nod of agreement. "In all of my past trials, I had the benefit of the system. Even if it wasn't a system I was familiar with, I was able to gain levels and skills throughout the trial. This is my first time where I was able to shed even that and test myself with only my natural instincts." "Still, don't push yourself too hard, all right?" he said in a kind tone. "I know you'll just restart if you fail, but don't get too focused on it that you lose sight of everything else." "I will keep that in mind." She nodded her head gently before pursing her lips. If you have seen my projection, I do have one question that I'd like to ask of you. Oh? The keeper seemed genuinely surprised and even intrigued by her question. Go on. I'm not used to you coming to me for help, especially in a trial. My question isn't strictly related to my trial, I suppose? Tsubaki shook her head. Within my trial, there is a great bird that can inflict instant death with a gaze. Given that I haven't seen any other signs of what could be a void beast infestation in the city, I thought perhaps the void beast might be this bird itself. However, if that is the case, killing it will be truly impossible. So I can only complete my trial by giving accurate information. If it is not the case, then giving that information would result in a failed trial either way. The keeper nodded his head with a small smile. I actually asked CC what the void beast in your simulation was. I can tell you, if you want, but I assure you that it is not the crow, and will not impact your trial in any conceivable way, whether you are aware of it or not. Tsubaki's eyes twitched a bit wider when she heard that. If that is the case, could you tell me about it? If it truly will not impact my trial, I would like to remove it sooner to offer myself some peace of mind. The keeper simply chuckled. Apparently, your eye color randomly changes every day. That is the extent of the void's influence on your simulation. When Tsubaki heard the keeper's words, her mouth hung open, dumbstruck by such a simple answer. Tsubaki never paid attention to her own eyes in the reflection. She always had other things to be looking for, such as movement behind her or making sure that her gear was properly equipped. She considered observing her own face in a mirror to be a form of vanity, something that she simply wasn't interested in. I see. Thank you for your advice, my keeper. If you had not told me, I don't know how long it would take for me to realize. She gave a deep bow of thanks, but the keeper simply waved his hand. At least she knew he was right. The color of her eyes would truly be unable to impact her trial in any way. More importantly, now that she knew that the crow was not a void beast, she had a better idea of how its power worked. Chapter 56. While Tsubaki was working on her latest trial, Dana was hard at work on her own project. Given the events of the most recent invasion, there was a serious need to increase both her own power and that of the world around her. For her own power, that was easy, and she already had her familiars working on that. The hard part was how to increase the overall level of the world. I can't create a system that will mass-produce legends, since every legend has to be unique to its wielder, Dana muttered to herself as she sat in her office, typing at her terminal. Although there was the distinct possibility that many future threats would originate from the void, she couldn't overlook the fact that monster gods exist, as did common criminals. The hardest part of her plan was how to increase the world's power without that power simply being used by villains to oppress people. It was not even remotely possible for her to act like the hammer of justice and punish villains across the various worlds. If I make an item that focuses purely on defense, it will be harder for bad guys to use it to attack people, but they could just use it to defend against the police as they run away, Dana grunted, holding her head in her hands. No matter what sort of control mechanism or regulations she thought of, she could always find ways for people to work around them. Dana took a deep breath, leaning back in her seat. Okay, let's look at this from a different angle. I'm not wanting to make the strong stronger. I just want to make a way for people who are weak to defend themselves. With that thought in mind, she didn't need to make a weapon that would be viable against the police, as the police had plenty of their own tools to deal with high-powered individuals. What she needed to do instead was to make something that could be mass-produced as easily as a standard spell card from Deccan. Well, as easily as the spell cards before V-Day were produced. The damage output needs to be the equivalent of a full-power strike from a level... Let's go with 350 mage. High enough that it can do serious damage, but not enough that standard law enforcement won't be able to overcome it. As Dana muttered to herself, she began drawing up various plans. And it has to be a focused attack, not something that will cause collateral damage, too. Dana thought about designing the weapon in a variety of forms, from a blade to a wand or even a firearm. However, none of them evoked the image that she was trying to portray. So instead, she changed the direction that she was working again. She fashioned the item as an accessory, a black bracelet with a blue gem. Naturally, the gem was a mage heart crystal, the power source of the bracelet. I'll need it to react to incoming dangers as well, and form a protective barrier. Thinking about this, Dana began writing a spell on her terminal. This would be the most complex spell that she had created since she had made Gerard. Each bracelet needed to be a pseudo-sentient spell, capable of analyzing the surroundings. Whenever it detected something that would threaten the wielder, it would deploy a preset defensive spell. Likewise, when manually activated by the wielder, it would launch a concentrated offense. Dana's plan was to limit the mana cost while it was in its passive mode. That way, even a child would be able to supply it with the mana necessary. As for its active mode, it would only function with the energy supplied by the mage heart to prevent someone from abusing its effect. It was only meant to be used in an emergency, after all. Unfortunately, the actual design work for a fourth-tier spell of this magnitude would take a considerable amount of time to finish. "Here it is," a voice spoke up as a portal opened onto a desolate world, its surface covered in a metallic layer. From the portal, a human man in a white lab coat emerged, carrying a clipboard in one hand. Behind him was a similarly dressed elven woman, her hands at her sides as she surveyed the landscape. "Are you sure that this is the place?" she asked, the man nodding his head. "According to the latest charts we could recover from before V-Day, this is the planet that they were using," he said, though his eyes swept the surroundings as well. It would appear that they had not been spared the cruelty of the event. "That much was obvious before we came. There's been no word from him in 50 years. Check the area and see if you can find any traces. I want the results in front of me within an hour." The man let out a sigh, nodding his head. His figure blurred, turning into blue light that swept into the horizon. Wherever he passed, a faint light scanned over the ground, seeming to be scanning beneath the surface. The woman waited impatiently, tapping her heel against the metal ground. She knew that it would take time even for a sentient spell to scan through an entire planet to look for traces of a dead civilization. Thus, she forced herself to wait for an hour. At the end of the hour, blue light swept back from the horizon again, reforming into the scientist that had left. He held two devices, one in each hand. "These are the only traces that I could find, stored in a safe that was isolated from all outside influences. It was truly a remarkable storage device." The woman looked down at the items. One was a black cube, the other seeming to be some form of remote. When she saw the remote, however, her brow twitched. She let out a long sigh, looking up at the man before her. "Are you enjoying your new body?" she asked in a flat tone, causing the man to blink. "Pardon?" "You can drop the act. Whether or not you've possessed him, it doesn't matter to me. However, I am familiar enough with his mana wavelength to determine when there is a discrepancy." The man paused before letting out a faint groan, his brown eyes turning red. "In that case, I should ask what brings you here, I suppose. With how long it has been, surely you have not also come to threaten me." The woman perked a brow at that. "You have a brilliant mind. If there was anything left of you, I wanted to bring it back to continue research. I didn't expect you to leave a backup of your mind that could override the personality matrix for a magical intelligence." "I don't know what happened while I was sealed, but I can take a guess looking around," he said with a long sigh. "I suppose it was some form of anti-technology attack?" "Quite. the woman confirmed, simply. All forms of technology were destroyed 50 years ago. We lost contact with you when that happened, so everyone has been operating under the assumption that your mechanical parts malfunctioned in the attack. Perhaps. It was the folly of my old form to hold on to the domains attached to my mechanical body. Had I created an energy from such as this, it would have spared me the trouble. Thankfully, I created this backup with just such a purpose. I had been stuck at the final step due to the limits of the device I saved myself in. When your friend found me, I was able to imprint myself upon him. The scientist gave a brief nod. As I said, whether or not you have replaced him does not bother me. We can restart a fresh version of him when we return. The spell entity raised his brow, looking at the woman. I have lost my people, my home, and quite frankly, my life. Why are you so confident that I will return with you? While he was still hesitant to attack this woman due to the threats of the ones who had visited him before, there was no reason for him to subject himself to her whims. The woman gave a small smirk. You're free to leave if you want. However, to ensure that the magical intelligence didn't go out of control, it was created with certain restrictions. First, it is incapable of creating advanced fourth-tier spells, and can only use the ones we have programmed into it. Secondly, it does not possess its own mana core, and requires regular infusions of Mage Heart to maintain itself. The former head of research for the gear widened his eyes slightly, gritting his teeth. So, you plan to blackmail me to join you back at your lab? Blame yourself for claiming the wrong host, the woman said, turning around to walk back to the portal. The man gave an eerie smile. You're right, he said, aiming the remote at her. Now that she had said so much, he had established that he was acting in defense of himself. I should upgrade. The woman looked back, not seeming to know what he meant. There was a flash as he pressed the button on the remote, the magical intelligence fading away. A metallic clink echoed as the remote and black cube fell to the floor. The female scientist hung her shoulders, frozen for several moments. When she moved, her eyes flashed red. A long groan echoed from her mouth as she cracked her neck from side to side. Ugh, an organic body. I'll need to take care of the upgrades soon, she said with a grin. The scientist looked at the open portal, closing her eyes and letting her eyes return to their normal brown. With that out of the way, she stepped through the portal, leaving the devices behind. On the other side, there was a man with swept back black hair, thin glasses on his face. Did you find him? He asked, without looking up from his terminal. The woman shook her head. Unfortunately, there was nothing left, other than a few security measures. Jax was destroyed by a null magic turret that activated while we were there. I see. I'll have another one initiated in the morning. In that case, you are dismissed, the man said, lightly waving his hand to dismiss her. The woman offered a respectful bow, turning to leave the room. Tsubaki let out a deep breath when she opened her eyes, seeing the light peeking in beneath the closed door. She still had 2 targets to take out, and needed to find a new weapon to use to do it. The police station would have been looted long ago. Most likely all of the powerful weapons will be in the hands of survivors and stalkers. With that thought in mind, Tsubaki felt her arm, glad that it had regained its mobility, even if it was still sore. She had to go hunting for a different type of prey now, in order to get what she needed to take on much larger targets. Chapter 57 For the first few hours of the day, Tsubaki ran around, scouting the area and the nearby survivors. Unfortunately, there was no way to specifically identify the differences between a normal survivor and a stalker, so she had to treat all of them as if they were stalkers. She watched parties walking through the cities from distant rooftops using a pair of binoculars that she looted from an abandoned sporting goods store. Whenever she found a small group of people, she would begin tracking them. Naturally, a group that emerged at a time like this would either be scavengers or looking for other survivors. Given that, she ended up following the same group for more than 3 hours before they returned to their base, an old elementary school. Tsubaki observed the school cautiously from a rooftop more than 100 meters away. The windows are all boarded. Given the size of the building, this could be a group of more than 100. However, it's impossible to know the exact numbers. What is clear is that they have the firepower to defend the school. It was this firepower that Tsubaki needed. Additionally, the school would be a far more defensible area than the house that she was currently using as her base. When she scanned the area, she saw that cars had been flipped over to cover all of the nearby manholes. They've either got at least 20 people or heavy machinery. There shouldn't be anything like a forklift in a school, so I should be able to rule that out. Just to be safe, Tsubaki waited on the rooftop for another 3 hours, until the sun had started to set. During that time, she saw another group of 4 survivors returning, one of them carrying what Tsubaki could recognize as a small-caliber rifle. Not big enough to hunt her main targets, and not even comparable to the weapons Tsubaki still had back at her safe house. Seeing the sun starting to go down, Tsubaki didn't try to make a mad dash for her place. Instead, she entered the building she had been spying from, made her way to an interior room, and closed herself in the closet. She didn't have any difficulties when it came to sleeping in an uncomfortable position, and so she patiently waited for another night to pass while considering her options. Because she was planning this as a hunting operation, she had brought her regular assortment of stealth weapons. On her lower back, she had a pair of kukri, sheathed, and on each hip she had a pair of throwing daggers. Finally, she had a silenced pistol strapped to her chest, with 3 magazines of spare ammunition. When Tsubaki awoke, she peered out of the closet, just to make sure any unwelcome guests didn't decide to occupy her temporary lodging during the night. Once she found that the location was safe, she quickly vacated the building and began to scout the school itself. The purpose of her scouting today was to find security cameras. A base of this size was bound to have its own generator, so she was confident that the cameras would still be operational, especially because she hadn't seen anyone patrolling the rooftops or along the grounds the day before. In the end, she managed to identify several cameras and found the blind spot that she would be using to raid the base. When she finalized her plan, she let the day slowly pass, briefly returning to her home to grab a bit of extra equipment. Once the sun was just starting to descend to the horizon, she made her move. Along the rear wall of the school building, one of the cameras had previously been broken, which Tsubaki assumed was the result of either a beast attack or a failed raid. Using that to her advantage, she began to scale the wall, climbing up along pipes and using the window sills for support. Thankfully, the windows were all blocked to protect those inside from the crow, so she wasn't afraid of being spotted. Once she made it to the roof, she walked over to the door, testing it briefly. She wasn't surprised to find that the door was locked, and fished a lock-picking set out of the bag she brought with her. She took a deep breath, focusing on the task at hand. She had given herself ample time to get into the building before the crow appeared, and soon heard the satisfying click of the lock. Inside, she closed and relocked the door, scanning the hallway to make sure that there weren't any cameras watching the door itself. Once she had confirmed this, she closed her eyes, listening close to any noises within the building. She could hear a few rattling cans and footsteps, as well as distant voices. As she expected, these noises abruptly stopped once the crow declared its presence in the city. Tsubaki was certain that other survivors, like herself, had grown accustomed to using that sound as an alert that it was time to sleep. At most, there might be 1 or 2 people watching the security cameras, but even that was only a slim chance. Almost as soon as the noise rang out, Tsubaki grabbed the other item from her bag, slipping it over her head. A pair of night vision goggles activated with a soft hum, and the dark passageway was lit up in a green light, in her vision. Tsubaki wasn't sure what the sleeping patterns were for stalkers, but she assumed that they would match humans to a degree. As long as that was the case, she wasn't concerned. The first thing that she did after she exited the stairway was to look for a map. It was a common practice for most schools to post maps at regular points along their interiors, so students would be able to find their way if they got lost. When she found one such map, she looked through it to identify the security room and immediately began to make her way there. Along the way, Tsubaki noticed a few traps set up in the hall, though they looked more like alarms than anything else. Empty cans strung up on lengths of rope, designed to cause loud noises if anyone touched it. Given their placement, Tsubaki assumed that they were set up as an early warning alarm against the spiders in the sewers more than other people, as they were not difficult to navigate for someone that knew what they were doing. When Tsubaki came across the door to the security room, she found it wide open, the camera displays having been turned off for the night. This didn't particularly reassure her, as it meant that she had lost the chance to take out some of their forces quietly. Logically, they should have their armory in a room near the security office. That would make it more convenient for the security to respond if a raid were to occur. If it were me, I would place it one or two rooms away, along the path to the front of the school. Tsubaki already believed that she knew where the bulk of the survivors in the school were sleeping. One of the lines of cans had been tied to a classroom's doorknob. Given what she heard while waiting for the sun to set, she was almost certain that was where they had settled in for the night. Thus, she walked down the hall, checking each door that she passed. They won't lock the armory unless every survivor can have their own key. After all, they're expecting attacks from the outside, not the inside. It's more efficient to make the weapons as accessible as possible in an emergency. With that thought in mind, Tsubaki walked half the hallway before one of the doors opened. She opened it just a crack at first, confirming whether or not there were any traps or alarms, before quietly opening it the rest of the way. Inside, it was just as Tsubaki had expected, with pistols, shotguns, rifles, even a few pipe bombs set out. Now, Tsubaki had two options. She could take only what she needed and try to leave under the cover of darkness, doing her best to avoid the crow. This was an option that only became available because she had confirmed that the security cameras were offline and hadn't alerted anyone yet. Alternatively, if she wanted to take the school for herself, she would need to kill all of its inhabitants. She believed that she was suitably armed to do so, but this would be no less challenging than the first choice. After all, if there were more than three stalkers among the group, they may be able to overpower her. Tsubaki took a deep breath, looking around at what they had available. There were three high-power sniper rifles like the one that she had broken. Among them, one looked like it had received special modifications, so she ignored it. The modifications may have made the rifle more powerful, but she wasn't going to risk using a weapon altered by someone other than herself. The other two rifles, on the other hand, she grabbed both of them, setting them stock down in a large backpack. She walked around the room, checking the ammunition, and gathered a small box of bullets to put in that same backpack, together with a few of the pipe bombs. Once she had gathered enough, she zipped up the backpack as tight as it could go to prevent the rifles from shaking around and causing too much noise, and began to make her escape. Because of the keeper's confirmation that the crow had nothing to do with the void, Tsubaki had been able to confirm how its power worked. It should be a psionic ability, she thought to herself as she walked down the hall, carefully avoiding any string alarms along the way. It's not constant, or else the snake would have died. I've never seen it moving around during the day, so it must change its locations at night while using its camouflage to hide from the crow's sight. That means that the crow can only attack creatures that it identifies in its line of sight. It might even require the target itself to look at the crow. As Tsubaki stood in front of the front door of the school, she knew that this was a gamble. One wrong step, and her trial would end here. Still, That was nothing new to her. If she was not always on the verge of death, the trial would have no real meaning. She took a deep breath, opening the door and sneaking out into the night. She had managed to avoid killing her way through the base, but getting back home would be another problem. There were no delusions in her mind that she could make the entire trek at night, as the area around her safe house was far too open to guarantee that she could avoid the crow's gaze. Instead, her goal was to get 1,000 meters from the school itself. If she managed that, she would have enough of a head start in the morning to make it back to her place without the survivors from the school finding her. The first thing that Tsubaki did outside was to scan the sky. Night had already fallen, so she had to check for the whereabouts of the crow. The fact that she didn't see it both comforted her and made her nervous. She wasn't in danger of immediately being seen, but at the same time, had no way of knowing when it would appear in this area. To avoid as much danger as possible, Tsubaki ran to the nearest alley. The bullets and rifles in her backpack jostled together, the noise barely audible within the night. Still, only moments after Tsubaki got to the alley, she heard the whoosh of air before the crow landed on the street. Tsubaki closed her eyes, pressing herself tight up against the wall of the alley and refusing to move. Only when she heard a brief cry from the crow and its wings taking flight again did she dare to breathe softly. Now she had to be even more careful, her goggles showing her the city's streets far more clearly than she could otherwise notice. Clear enough, even, that she saw a massive thing lying on the street, its body remaining still for several long moments, before slowly slithering along. Interesting, Tsubaki thought to herself, moving in the opposite direction where she saw the snake going. I might be able to get both of them at once, if I plan it right. Chapter 58 Tsubaki spent the first half of the following day simply finding the materials that she would need to enact her plan. What she was looking for could be found in most hardware or sporting goods stores, but she was confident that nobody among the survivors would be interested in these niche goods, as they would generally be counterproductive to the survival of anyone that owned them. Once she had acquired her materials, she went back to her safe house, checking her maps. She had seen the snake on the road the night before, and used that information to determine its most likely nest for the day. There were only so many buildings in each part of the city that could house it, after all. After Tsubaki found her possible targets, she hurried to investigate them. If she gave it another day, the snake might move again, and she would need to start her scouting all over again. Thankfully, she had an easy way to tell if it was hiding in a particular building, as long as she avoided the other monsters along the road. There were a total of 3 buildings large enough to house the snake in the area that Tsubaki had seen it traveling to. When she arrived at them, all she needed to do was use the pipe bombs that she had confiscated from the school group previously. By throwing one deep into a second-story window, she could create a shockwave that the snake wouldn't be able to ignore if it was there. At the first building, she lit and threw her explosive, ducking behind a nearby street corner. She could hear the explosion and feel the faint vibration that managed to reach her from it. Then she counted a total of 30 seconds. If the snake was in there, it would have to respond within that time period. When 30 seconds passed and there was no sign of her target, she simply moved on to her next target building. Staying any longer would just invite unwanted guests to find her. Thus, she moved to repeat the process with the second building several blocks away. In the second building, there was a response almost immediately after the pipe bomb exploded. The ground shook as a massive black head emerged from one of the windows, scanning the area. Tsubaki knew that it could see her, even if she just barely peeked out to confirm its presence. However, the serpent didn't leave its nest. That was how it hunted. It didn't care if someone was outside of its nest, not unless they inflicted actual pain on it. Only then would it leave its nest. Otherwise, it was happy to devour any monsters or people that recklessly entered. Tsubaki smiled when she saw that the serpent pulled its head back in. No doubt it was adjusting itself to be ready for a nice meal if she entered. But she had no intention of doing so. Instead, she entered the adjacent building and began to climb the stairs, getting out of the way of any other monsters that would be drawn by the noise. Let them be the snake's meal. As for Tsubaki, she climbed to the roof of the building she had entered, scanning through the open windows to look for her target. It didn't take long to find large splotches of blurred colors where the snake had camouflaged its body. With a node, she pulled out the equipment that she had brought and took aim. This was a simple paintball gun, with an effective range of 100 meters, more than enough for her to hit her target. She steadied her aim and began pulling the trigger, letting small green beads fly out. It was hard to tell if the snake even felt the paintballs hitting its side, the green paint splashing out to cover a small area each time it hit. Tsubaki covered as much of the snake as she could through that open window, before scanning to find another spot she could shoot. Soon she felt the ground shaking and immediately fell to a prone position. On the street a large rat appeared, its body nearly as large as a car. It had been attracted by Tsubaki's previous explosion, drawn out into thinking that it could find some survivors for an easy meal. Tsubaki reached down, gently lifting the lid of a metal can she had set next to her. She lifted her head just high enough to watch the rat approaching the building. When its nose poked through the door, sniffing for danger, there was a sudden rush of motion. Tsubaki quickly stood, grabbing the can and throwing it with all her might. At the same time, the serpent's head emerged like lightning from the open doorway, engulfing half of the rat all at once. There was a brief struggle as the rat tried to fight back, but the snake continued to swallow more of it. Meanwhile, the can crashed into the building, above the snake's head, spilling its contents downwards. This time, she didn't wait to test the serpent's patience. Tsubaki abandoned both her paintball gun and remaining ammunition, turning and running to the fire escape to jump to the opposite building. There was no telling if her last action would trigger the serpent's ire, so she couldn't take the risk. Either way, she had achieved her goal for the day. She made her way back to her safe house, taking a quick rest to ensure that she was ready for the night's events. After her rest, she made her way back to the area where she knew the snake to be hiding, and found that the building she had shot from earlier had been demolished. Clicking her tongue, she chose to enter the building that she had already confirmed to be safe earlier in the day. This building had a good view of both the snake's current nest and the surrounding area, so Tsubaki made her way to the top floor, finding a spot to wait in between a pair of windows. She closed her eyes, ignoring everything else, to just wait for twilight to come. When she heard the crow's call, she knew that it was time to hunt. A smile surfaced on her face, and she kept waiting. The paint that she had used earlier in the day was bioluminescent. In other words, the snake would be glowing in the dark whenever it moved now, making it the perfect target for the crow. Of course, the paint could simply be washed off, but she was certain that the snake wouldn't have that level of intelligence. So she waited, and soon heard a second call. This was Tsubaki's signal, the indication that the crow had identified its prey. She turned her body, leaning into the window and aiming her rifle. The light had not entirely faded, and she could make out enough to target a being as large as the crow. When she caught sight of her targets, the serpent shuddered, its glowing head pausing for a moment as the crow swept down onto it. So it has some resistance. Good to know. But not enough. She had caused the two giant beasts to fight each other. As long as the crow continued its psionic attack, it would surely win. The crow seemed to realize this as well, letting out another caw as soon as it saw the snake coiling up to strike. Tsubaki's rifle was loaded, aiming at the back of the crow's head. After its third caw, when the serpent finally fell limp, it moved in to pick it up by its body. She waited for that one moment when the crow's body would be still, trying to pick up the immense weight of the serpent. As soon as its head stopped, she pulled the trigger. She didn't wait for confirmation of the kill, immediately ducking back behind the wall. A bird's bones were naturally hollow, so the crow's skull shouldn't be as hard to pierce as that of other animals. Still, even with armor-piercing rounds, she wasn't confident that she had killed it in one strike. Sure enough, there was a screech of pain, and Tsubaki felt a throbbing heat in her head, causing her to wince and grip her forehead. As soon as it passed, she took a deep breath. She grabbed her rifle and turned, finding the crow staring in her direction from just outside the window. On pure instinct, she pulled the trigger, the bullet rocking back the bird's head once again. Its eyes flashed, but it had lost sight of its target with the second shot. Worse, its brain had been rattled too much, leaving it dazed. Tsubaki took advantage of this to load a third bullet, aiming for the underside of the creature's throat. The third bullet shot out, piercing a hole into the crow's throat. This time, Tsubaki didn't try to fire another bullet and ran to the innermost room of this floor. She knew that she had dealt a lethal blow, and now she needed to make sure that she survived longer than the crow. As long as she achieved that goal, she would have passed her trial. The building shook, along with the gurgled cries of the giant monster outside, its talons tearing into the walls. She could feel the tremors when it shoved its head into the window, but didn't dare to make herself visible. All she could do was wait, and hope that it wasn't able to make it far enough into the building to reach her before its injuries got the better of it. She heard the chaotic sounds outside slowly dwindling over the course of the next 10 minutes, before a loud crash signaled to her the death of the crow. Only then did Tsubaki poke her head out, gradually moving to investigate. She was certain that the crow was dead, but still needed to confirm that the snake was motionless. Outside, she found that the crow had actually landed on the snake's body, the two of them lying in a heap on the ground. She nodded her head with a smile.
"Sisi, just to make sure, they are both dead, right?" she asked, grabbing her rifle again in case Sisi said an answer she wasn't expecting.
The crow had torn through almost half of the floor to get to her, but that also made it incredibly easy for her to aim at the targets below.
"The crow is, indeed, dead," Sisi said,
Tsubaki immediately aiming at the snake's head. There was no sign of movement, leading her to believe that the snake might be faking it.
"As for the snake, it is technically still alive, but was rendered comatose by the multiple psionic shocks. If it's not treated within the next few hours, it will be brain dead."
Tsubaki let out a brief sigh when she heard that.
"End the simulation."
A smile spread across her lips when she sent that message. The world around her went dark, and she felt the familiar visor on her head again. Tsubaki pulled the visor off of her face, setting it aside and sitting up. She always felt a sense of accomplishment when she completed one of her trials, and this was no different. In fact, this time may have been even more satisfying because of the fact that she had no ability to bring her powers into play, whether she wanted to or not. From the beginning to end, she was only a normal person, relying on what was in her surroundings. Additionally, this was her first time holding such a trial in an urban setting, which made it all the more challenging for her to adapt in the early stages. Despite all of this, she managed to complete her trial in a single run. In the back of her mind, she began to think of how she could have made the trial more difficult for herself, but shook her head. If she had been in a wilderness setting, she wouldn't have had access to the firepower necessary to take down any of the giant monsters, nor the ability to expose them to the crow's power. If she had added more powerful enemies, conventional firearms wouldn't have been effective at all. Perhaps the only way she could have made such a trial more difficult would be if she had made it a conspiracy instead. A trial where the only monsters were the stalkers, and she had to identify their leader through context clues without being uncovered. That could have been a national event, and it would definitely have been more difficult. However, it would have also taken her months to complete a single run,
and it would rely more on her investigative prowess as opposed to her fighting instincts. Because of that, Tsubaki didn't particularly feel like it was a suitable trial. Chapter 59. Asnod stood at the gate of the 61st floor of Fior, a thick material covering his body, similar to a hazmat suit. As he had helped find the material needed to allow them to survive on the 61st floor, Asnod had been invited to join an expedition after it had been determined that the initial area around the portal was safe. To his right was a much smaller hazmat suit, the top of the helmet pushed up by a pair of horns. Petra had been invited as well, due to her history of clearing the floors quickly. "What do you think is the cause for this energy?" Petra said, as she looked at the pink mist filling the air. She had tried to expand her world shadow to claim this floor, but found the energy being devoured as soon as it left her protective suit. This was problematic for her, as Thelsa would no doubt need every layer of Fior in order to truly complete her shadow world. Asnod hesitated for a moment before taking a guess. "There are two possibilities, though they are rather similar. Either this energy is being released by a special mineral akin to tide stones, or there is a primordial artifact on this floor with the theme of devouring, and it has caused the air to become like this." "If it's an artifact, why wouldn't it eat the ground?" Petra asked, the two walking further away from the gate. Although they had been invited to the expedition, they were both essentially given the freedom to do as they wished. After all, who would restrain the husband of one member of the Greater Pantheon, or the daughter of another? "If I had to guess, it would be because the power developed a distaste for the soil," he answered thoughtfully. He knew that he could just ask Udana for the correct answers, but that would spoil the point of discovery. Besides, there could be new ingredients to be found in a world such as this.
"Maybe.
Though, how are we going to fight in these things if there are any monsters around?" Petra asked, worriedly, looking down at her hazmat suit. In fact, that was an excellent question in Asnod's eyes as well. "Hopefully that will not be an issue," Asnod said, looking up at the pink mist that blocked out their view. "Petra, do you have any method of locating the next gate in these circumstances?" Petra simply shook her head. "I've got two ways that I normally use, but neither of them will work here. We need to get rid of the energy in the mist, or else we're moving blind."
"Oh, come on, it's not that bad."
A pale-skinned girl ran over in front of Asnod and Petra, her blue eyes all but shining at them. Unlike the two of them, she wasn't wearing any form of hazmat suit. Also, unlike the two of them, she hadn't been invited to join, but rather invited herself to join.
"Just think of it as an adventure, right? When's the last time that you two went on real adventures?"
"I live a life of almost constant fighting and training. I'd say I get adventure enough," Petra smirked slightly, shaking her head at the energetic Lifra. "Lifra, why do you not need a suit?" Asnod asked, hesitantly, seeing that Lifra's body wasn't being devoured by the mist.
"Huh? Oh, I ate it. Now my skin has the same kind of property as that suit, so I can run around here however I want."
Petra and Asnod looked to one another when Lifra said that, silently determining that she would be the one to fight if they really had to enter combat.
"In that case, do you have a way to find the gate?" Petra asked, hopefully, "or maybe the source of this mist?"
Lifra blinked, tapping her chin in thought.
Let me check," she said, before condensing a thick golden book from her energy. No, not that one, not that one. Why did I write about that? I'll think about that later. Oh, here it is,"
Lifra smiled brightly, placing a hand on the page that she had turned to. When she pulled her hand away, she revealed that she was now holding a compass, causing the other two to look at her in confusion.
"To what does your compass point?" Asnod asked.
"Dunno," she said with that same smile. "This is one of my plot devices. It's a compass that points to wherever I need to go to advance the story." "You're a writer, so I guess the fourth wall just doesn't exist for you, does it?" Petra asked hesitantly, causing Lyfra to laugh. "Either way, let's let the others know that we have a destination. Does your compass tell you how far away it is?"
Asnod nodded his head, turning to head to the expedition leader, while Lyfra shook her head.
"Nope. I could triangulate its position if I go about 1,000,000 kilometers in the wrong direction, but at that point the compass might try to tell me to go somewhere else. I find it's better to just listen to the compass for the sake of the story."
"Right." Petra nodded her head helplessly. Personally, she didn't feel like spending years of her life in a hazmat suit, following a slime girl on an endless, mist-filled meadow. When Asnod returned, Petra looked at him with hope in her eyes.
"Please tell me you have a way for us to quickly travel without needing to walk. Teleportation spells won't work in this mist."
Asnod smiled slightly, nodding his head. "Udana prepared something for me before I came here." As he said that, he retrieved a magic card from his inventory. To Petra's surprise, the card didn't dissolve when it came into contact with the pink mist. Asnod threw the card forward after activating it, the card shining brightly. Then, a moment later, darkness covered them. The light from above was blocked out by a large aircraft. Internally, Petra thought it looked like a spaceship with its sheer size, but that wasn't really a surprise. After all, the floors of Fior this high were so big that you could fit entire solar systems in them.
"You know how to fly that, right?" she asked, to which Asnod nodded his head.
"Of course. Additionally, she told me that the airlock should be able to prevent any of the mist from entering the ship, though I would still keep the suits on just in case of any damage." Petra nodded sullenly when she heard that, though Lyfra was already running for the lowered ramp. The expedition team climbed aboard the craft, Asnod making his way to the front to sit in the pilot's seat. This was a ship that he had obtained with Udana in fragments of Assyria, and Udana had recreated it in Deccan, replacing the outer coating with the material that Asnod had discovered to be effective against the local energy. Thus, he was confident in being able to fly wherever they needed to go.
"Lyfra, would you mind providing directions?" he asked with a smile.
Lyfra nodded her head quickly, her body immediately warping to turn into a much larger version of the compass that she stored at the center of her being.
"That's not what I had in mind, but it will do, I suppose."
There was a hum from the engines as the ship lifted off the ground, Asnod taking it higher and higher into the air. "We can only see a few hundred meters in front of us. This ship is rated as F4 class in fragments, but I'd rather not test its inertial dampeners if we were to drive directly into a mountain." The others widened their eyes, quickly nodding their heads in agreement, as Lyfra's chuckle emerged from the giant compass.
"Hehehe, splat!"
"Yes, Lyfra, splat indeed," Asnod said with a sigh, activating the sunlight engines and flying to an altitude of more than 1,000,000,000 kilometers. "If there are still any mountains this high, we can only blame our bad luck," he said, before driving forward, slowly increasing the speed of the ship. Lyfra continued to diligently point the way forward, the expedition leader leaning in from behind.
"I suppose that this is considerably safer than wandering around on foot. What exactly are we looking for, though?"
"If I knew the answer to that, I assure you that I would inform you of it," Asnod sighed, shaking his head. "Lyfra's compass points to our destination. However, that destination is an abstract concept of where we need to go. It could be taking us to the source of the mist, the gate to the next level, this layer's level sphere, or even just a powerful monster. We won't know until we arrive." Those words were certainly not as helpful as what the expedition leader had wanted to hear. He couldn't even tell how fast the ship was going, because the outside just appeared to be a blur of pink mist. It wasn't until Lyfra let out a loud ding that Asnod decelerated, seeing the needle on the compass now pointed directly behind them.
"Above or below?"
Asnod asked, given that they might be looking for something embedded in the ceiling of this layer. Lyfra flipped over onto her side, the arrow of her compass pointing straight down. With a nod, Asnod began to descend,
finding that the mist had grown thicker and thicker as the ship lowered.
"It seems Lifra has brought us to the source of the energy pervading this floor," he said with a sigh, though Petra's face had become more serious.
"Asnod, do you have anything to clear the mist beneath us, even if it's just for a moment?" she asked, clenching her fists in her hazmat suit.
Asnod hesitated to answer, thinking it over. "If I release a condensed energy pulse downwards, it should be able to expel the mist before it is consumed, though it will use more than 60% of the ship's energy reserves."
"Do it," Petra said, without a second thought, staring out the window. "And make sure to activate the cameras below us."
Every nerve in her body was screaming of danger, and she couldn't simply shake that feeling.
Asnod nodded his head, manipulating the console in front of himself.
"Building the charge and lower shields, activating landing cameras, expelling charge in 3, 2, 1.
Petra's eyes were glued to the screen when the countdown finished, the pink mist dissipating when the blast reached the ground. Petra's eyes widened, as did the eyes of everyone else in the ship. There was a massive circular pit in the ground where the energy had struck, its edges writhing with jagged teeth that seemed to be formed from mountains. Pink mist shot from the center of the mouth, quickly obscuring view once again.
"We all just saw that, right?" the expedition leader asked, his gaze shaking.
Petra nodded her head. "So, when the primordial artifact activated, it merged with the ground. That's why the soil contains a material that is safe from being devoured, because it is part of the thing's body."
"Cool!"
Lifra's voice spoke up from the compass, which immediately turned back into the pale petite girl.
"I'ma go poke it with a stick," she declared, a golden sword forming in one hand.
"Is that wise?"
the expedition leader asked, his nervousness evident even beneath his hazmat suit.
"I don't mean to doubt your ability, but you saw the scale of that thing. Can you take it on by yourself?"
Lifra blinked, looking at the man.
"I don't know," she admitted, before a wide smile filled her face. "That's what makes it fun. Let's see who eats the other one first, right?"
Chapter 60
Lifra's grin widened as she descended into the gaping chasm, plunging her body into the source of the pink mist. She could feel her sword already starting to erode, and so dismissed it to prevent herself from losing her divine artifact.
"Just you and me, huh?" she asked with a manic laugh,
not even trying to stop her descent. Her eyes scanned as much as they could, trying to identify a weak point. Unfortunately, she wasn't even able to see the edges of the chasm through the mist. She clicked her tongue, deciding to simply fall until she reached the bottom. She had already ensured that she was immune to the mist, after all.
"This thing doesn't appear to have any real form of attack other than the mist. It doesn't even move. Hey, does it even know I'm in its mouth?"
She had to wonder that, given its sheer size. Comparing this creature to a normal human, she would be about as big as a single atom.
"If I kill this thing, that will be the ultimate giant slaying."
With that, her grin returned, and she waited and waited, falling through the pink mist as it blew past her figure. If not for the rushing wind and the constant sensation of gravity, she would have begun to wonder if she was being held in place. Suddenly, the pink mist parted to reveal glossy stone, mere inches from her face. Lifra's eyes widened as she collided with the ground at terminal velocity, splashing out as a puddle of goop. Pulling herself together in a literal sense, she let out a sigh.
"I have been falling for 30 minutes, she complained, looking around. "I think it was probably longer than that, but I can't wear a watch in this place," she muttered.
At the very bottom of the chasm, the mist didn't seem as dense. Additionally, she was able to see where it was being emitted from. It wasn't simply some crystal that had fused into the ground like she expected. Rather, there was a smooth circular gem held in warped and coiled stone, like a staff protruding from the ground. The mist gushed forth from the gem,
filling the air and rising upwards. Lifra's brow furrowed at the sight of the place where the gem was mounted.
"That's not a natural formation," she muttered, walking closer.
As she did, she sent a message to Terra mentally.
"Hey, big boss lady, can you send a message to the others to let them know that I'm okay and totally didn't splat face first into the ground?"
"You want me to lie to them, then?" Terra asked in an amused tone.
"Pretty please, they'll just worry otherwise,"
she responded, observing the structure that appeared to be some form of altar. She couldn't make out any markings, though they would have either been eroded by the mist or the passing of countless years.
"Let's see. How did he say it goes?"
she muttered, focusing her energy in her eyes.
"There we go. Wait, it's not hunger or anything like that?"
she asked in surprise. She didn't often observe the domains of others, finding it more fun to learn by experience. Still, she had been sure that the domain of the primordial relic behind this would be something to do with devouring. Instead, the domain that she read from the crystal was nature.
"So, whatever this is corrupted the natural energy of this area, turning it into that poison.